and welcome to the Watershed Investigations, Tales from the Frontline of the Water Crisis. I'm Rachel Salvage, and I'm here, as usual, with Liana Hosea. Now, in this episode, we're looking at what we think is a bit of a Cinderella issue, the chemical pollution of our seas and our oceans, which we know usually begins on land and in our rivers. So across the world, there are lots of huge, dirty industrial complexes polluting air, soils and water with their emissions. How much they're allowed to release depends on the rules of that country in which they're operating, and of course, whether or not those rules are enforced.
And someone who knows all about just how bad things can get is Desmond Desar, an environmentalist and Goldman Prize winner from Durban on South Africa's east coast, where a warehouse full of toxic agrochemicals caught fire in 2021. South Africa's Minister of Environment, Barbara Creasy, said it was the most serious environmental catastrophe in recent times, and it has wreaked devastation on local communities and killed tons of marine life. Welcome to the podcast, Desmond. Thank you for joining us. Please, could you start by painting a picture of what happened in the early hours of the 13th of July, 2021?
Well, in 2021, we had an episode just after COVID, you know, and the entire industrial complex was shut down. However, in June, there was a huge riot and looting. And so from what we gather is that this company had stored tons of over 150 different pesticides that were produced in Europe were stored here. A lot of the pesticides made in Europe that were banned products, we only got to know about that months later. So I was woken up with people frantically calling me. So when I was called out, the first thing I done is go out there, talk to people, smell the smell, drive around, look at the water, saw the dead fish.
What did it smell like?
The stench was terrible. Because, you know, dead fish was really bad, and it was the air that was more really bad as well. You know, when you're breathing the air, then you realize there's something much more than ordinary chemicals. And so I immediately called people, and we went back the next morning, and we took the air sampling, we took the water sampling, and we sent all this to accredited laboratory to be analyzed. However, the company, UPL, was the first time I was engaging with them. And they wouldn't want to talk to us. We went through the factory. We then got national government involved.
Because initially the company who were using the warehouse, which is an Indian company called United Phosphorus Limited, wouldn't release a full inventory of the chemicals, would they? But they finally did, and you did your sampling as well. I mean, what did you find in your sampling? Because the river, I saw pictures of the river, and it was this unnatural aquamarine blue, wasn't it? And then it, obviously you're on the coast, so that river was pouring straight into the ocean.
So the pesticides, where when it mixes, the properties change, the color changes, right? You could hardly breathe, you struggled to breathe. And I walked the road. I walked the riverbend past communities where they use the water and into the ocean where all the fish were killed. The stench was terrible. It was a bluish color of water. We took all that there and we found that there were quite a number of pesticides in it. But what was more critical, the company refused to divulge anything. Only later on in the process that we were able to get a lot of information through an independent technologist who was appointed out of the UK. But the scene itself, the burning carried on for weeks on end. Every time the wind direction changed, it would blow onto the community. The people were sick. A lot of the poor communities were rushing to clinics and to hospitals. And even there, they weren't getting the right medication for this sort of illnesses. They were getting normal, cheap, normal medication that wouldn't even help. So people there are still affected that live around there, still affected. And the community out there that lives in the upmarket area have also been affected. So we had to join the boat communities to come together and to fight this company.
Can you describe how many people were taken ill and what their symptoms were, Desmond?
Yeah, there's a radius of over 10 kilometers, over 200,000 people, especially in the townships and in the upmarket areas. But the local community is right next to the storage facility. They about over 1,000 people.
What were their symptoms?
Yeah, they've all got symptoms, and the company refused to provide an assessment. They've done a risk assessment to cover their backs. not to expose that the pesticides pose a high risk, even though the literature is out there that shows that the pesticides has a huge impact on people, especially breathing it in. It gets into your veins, into your respiratory organs. It has a huge impact on people's skin, and your breathing has a problem.
So I read that one of the gases that was released was hydrogen cyanide, which was one of the gases that was used in Auschwitz gas chambers. Is that correct? And did anybody die as a result of these emissions?
That's correct. Well, there are people dying, but you know what happens in poor communities? They don't have the finances to have an autopsy so that you can get to the truth. So the company got away with that, even though they knew. The government did not side with us. We had to fight and get the national minister to come down, Barbara Creasy, to intervene in the province because the provincial government was not willing to do anything. And despite the fact that they've opened up a case, that case has not proceeded to bring the company and their directors before a court of law in South Africa to be held accountable, so let the courts decide. So it's left to us as community to find the necessary resources, find the legal team.
Is there any health monitoring happening now?
There's none monitoring now besides us taking the water sampling all the time. So all the pesticides are in dams and all, they built dams around the place. And that when it rains heavy, and we've had a huge amount of rain in Durban, it all ends up back into the river and into the ocean. So we've been taking water samples and things have not changed much since the incident occurred.
So there's still a huge amount of pollution washing into the river, the sea, and it's still impacting the local people?
Yes, because the local people do not have access to clean running water, especially north of Durban. So people use the river water. But this has a huge impact, and we've lost a lot of marine life. So there's hardly any fish where people can catch any fish north or south of that area. But in the area itself, I've been talking to the local fisher folks, and they said, look, there's no fish here. Local tourists in South Africa have not come to Durban because of the contamination of the ocean and the rivers.
So low-income people who rely on fishing to be able to eat or make a living, their ability to provide food for their families has been decimated. And as we've discussed in our earlier podcast on Cape Town, many poor black communities and people living in townships and informal settlements don't have access to running water. And the water infrastructure in many places in South Africa now is really collapsing. So people are having to rely and use the river water more. You've been taking water samples from the river. What are they showing?
Yeah, we found high levels of pesticides, the different pesticides, as you say, hydrogen cyanide and others. We found that in the water samples. We found that in the ocean as well.
Do you know why there was hydrogen cyanide in the water? Because that's not used in pesticide, is it?
Well, it could be used in any of the products. Remember, we have sugarcane manufacturing there, and we don't know what else was stored in the storage facility. The seepage went into the ground before it entered the water, and that has not been cleaned up. And that's why we have a constant pollution in the water, because whenever there are heavy rains and all that, that goes into the river. The company tried to clean it up because the city wouldn't allow them to dump. And when they were wanting to continue to dump, they were told they had to take it to a hazardous toxic landfill site. They did not want to take it to a toxic landfill site in Johannesburg, where there's a big toxic landfill site. They wanted to push it into the water or take it to a sewage works or Southern works where the chemicals are treated and then pushed to sea. And the local government, again, did not allow that.
Well, it's unlikely that the local water plant would be able to take out pesticides.
Well, that's what they thought they could get away with. We stood up and said, no way can the communities in South Durban be the sacrificial zone for UPL to dump its pesticides and chemicals into our rivers, into our works. And that can end up in the ocean because it'll destroy all the fish here. And we'll find that we're eating poisoned fish.
Are there any cleanup operations in place or planned?
They've cleaned up minimum. And so our plan is to put pressure on government. We're looking at how do we raise the money for a team, a legal team and experts who can then develop a strong case that we can put before the courts in Durban and throughout the country. This is a multi-billion rand company. So it's got the resources to take on people like us.
Has anyone received any compensation from the companies or from the government?
There's no compensation at all. Not a cent being provided towards a loss of a livelihood, a loss of earnings by the tourism industry, as well as the people affected who had to stay at home for months on end because they were sick.
I mean, United Phosphorus Limited obviously point to the fact that the warehouse they were using was set on fire due to unrest in the area and it wasn't their fault. But then the government report obviously points to the fact that they didn't have the proper permits for all the chemicals that they were storing. So in your opinion, what responsibility do you think the company and the government has for this environmental catastrophe?
Yeah, look, they're both responsible. Firstly, let me say that the company should have applied for a legal permit and undergo stringent environmental impact assessments, which they did not do. They never conducted it. They did not even inform the point of authority. So the people that manage our harbors didn't even know that these pesticides that were banned in other parts of the world were brought in here. No one knew about it.
Well, didn't the government know about it? The government should have known about that.
Government should have had more measures. So they failed. This is not something new. You know, we have reported that chrome and the mercury was brought from Europe and dumped in South Africa many years ago. And no one knew about it, and government should have been aware of it and should have sent the mercury back to sender. So likewise with this, they should have been aware. So somebody has to be held accountable for this within government. If that warehouse did not blow up in fire, we would not ever have known that these illegal chemicals and poisons have been brought into South Africa. But I think it makes us more aware that we have to have oversight. Society has to work even harder to make sure that these things never happen.
So I put a number of questions to United Phosphorus Limited South Africa, and they sent me this statement. UPL South Africa have led extensive efforts to communicate clearly and transparently about the work we have been leading with national, provincial and local authorities, the communities surrounding Cornubia, scientific experts and environmental specialists. Extensive monitoring and evaluation work is ongoing to assess the continuing reduction of substances related to the spill. For some time, monthly testing shows that the majority of substances related to the spill are no longer present or are at such low concentrations they cannot be quantified by a laboratory. Now, Rachel, I actually asked twice for the raw monitoring data to see those test results of the substances found, but UPL did not send any, so that's just not available. But UPL went on to say that they said they always conduct their business within the laws and regulations of South Africa. I approached the South African government for comment, but I didn't get any response or comment or update on the situation.
So the chemical fire in Durban is just one example of the catastrophes that can unfold when things go wrong. But some industrial complexes are polluting as part of their every day-to-day processes and fly under the radar in terms of public awareness. And then there are those instances of what could be described as unwitting pollution. As Watershed, we've recently published a couple of stories on this. So one was about the potential for mercury to be leaching out of abandoned and corroding oil and gas pipelines that had been abandoned at the bottom of the North Sea. Another was about long-banned toxic substances called PCBs that are still being manufactured in huge volumes as byproducts when other chemicals are made. Now, if you're interested in this, both of these stories can be found on The Guardian's website if you want to find out a bit more.
Our next guest, Elsie Sunderland, is Professor of Environmental Chemistry at Harvard University and Ambassador of Back to Blue, a project set up to address ocean pollution. Welcome, Professor Sunderland. We've just been speaking to Desmond Desar, a campaigner for Durban in South Africa, where almost 3 years ago, a chemical warehouse caught fire, devastating the environment and local communities. And the impacts are still being felt today. But when it comes to the bigger picture of chemical pollution in our oceans, what do we know about the scale of the problem?
That's a great question. I think we understand the site-specific impacts related to specific spills or accidents in marine environments. For perhaps threatening a fishery or becoming a local public health concern. And what we understand less is the broader scale global impacts of this pollution, not just on nearshore ecosystems, but on offshore ecosystems as well. Fisheries are one of our last wild foods. And so there's a vector whereby ocean pollution can impact human health. Mercury and Io accumulates in seafood and is a potent neurotoxin and can affect cardiovascular health in adults. PCBs are also affect normal brain function if you're exposed early in life. Some of them are carcinogenic, and PFAS are probably the worst actor that we have of the newer contaminants, and we're just getting our head around how much of these chemicals are actually being released into the marine environment. We know we use them in very large quantities in everyday products. You know, the terminal sink for everything we do on land ends up eventually through transport, through rivers, or atmospheric deposition in the ocean. And so that's not great for marine life.
Our last guest was talking about a fire in a warehouse in Durban containing large amounts of pesticides which washed out into the river and sea when the fire was put out. After the first marine die-off, you sort of think, well, out of sight, out of mind, maybe that's not a problem anymore. Is that the case? Because the ocean is huge and it can dilute all these chemicals, and then the thought is that, well, it's not so toxic. So is it such a big deal?
Yeah, so in my classes, we talk about the solution to pollution is dilution. And then we kind of chuckle because that certainly was the paradigm when a lot of this chemical manufacturing began, even when we started to develop waste disposal systems. So a lot of major cities in North America and Europe developed waste infrastructure to just, you know, basically flush it out into estuaries and the oceans. And after doing that for a few decades, discovered, oh, well, you know, we're producing so much that the system is actually accumulating very large amounts of things like heavy metals and organic pollutants. And it's kind of the same idea with the oceans. Like, the oceans are big, they will dilute human pollution that we release, but there is a finite capacity. And some of them, like the PFAS, you know, they have the moniker forever chemicals because they are not known to degrade. And you guys have already talked about things like PCBs, which were banned in the 1970s, but we still see them in sensitive marine ecosystems like the Arctic at concerning levels and in marine mammals. And they can be toxic at very, very, very low concentrations.
We're hitting what are known as planetary boundaries for chemical pollution, which sounds terrifying. Which chemicals are the ones that we should be addressing first? If you're talking about these persistent organic pollutants, and then we've got the heavy metals, and then we've got the ones that we're only starting to learn about, and microplastics and nanomaterials and all this kind of stuff. How do you go about addressing that? What's the solution to cleanup? What's the solution to stopping the flow of these chemicals in the first place?
The first question we want to ask is, do we really need these chemicals? So are they essential in the products we're using? Do we know that their functionality isn't possible with something that we know to be less persistent or less toxic? You know, it's a bit like the climate crisis in that we have a problem, we see warning signals, we still have time to take action and make better decisions and better choices. But if we're not aware of the problem and we're not concerned about it, and we don't start asking some very basic questions like, what chemicals do we use in our products? What is their impact on life? And then how long will they persist in the environment? Then we can't really design a better process for the materials that we're using.
You say that the impacts, you know, aren't so visible at the moment. Liana made the point of out of sight, out of mind. But could it also be because it's so sort of insidious? So the impacts for public health could be low level and chronic, but could be having sort of later in life health problems that you could never pin down to one particular source.
Those broader public health impacts known to be associated with these chemicals are things like low-level impacts on neurodevelopment, so maybe losing a few IQ points or slightly impaired cardiovascular health. Immunotoxicity is something we're talking about a lot these days, and we see public health statistics that to me are alarming. We see you know, 1 in 6 children are now diagnosed with some sort of neurodevelopmental disorder, mostly of unknown causes. Why is that happening? Epidemiological studies, so where we followed human populations, points to the environment as the vector for disease. And again, that's partly why I'm so concerned about this broader planetary level, low-level pollution rising.
And as part of the Back to Blue project, I think there were hundreds of interviews with scientists, policymakers, and industry people, and two separate stories emerged depending on who was telling the story. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and how industry responded to perhaps push back on their narrative?
I think scientists generally agree this is an issue. We need to reshape how we think about chemical production and chemical management and waste management. And on the other side, something, you know, like PFAS chemicals are extremely profitable. There's an incentive to want to keep manufacturing them. So industry tells us again and again that a product is safe. And the way most of our regulatory systems are set up, the burden of proof is actually to prove that there is a harm, not for industry to say, you know, this product has been proven to be safe. And I think a lot of people don't realize that.
Well, how can you even really trust industry? You talk about bringing them on board, they need to be part of the discussion, but it's only been when they've been taken to court or forced to make change through legislation that there's ever been any action. For example, the two PFAS substances that were banned followed a lawsuit by Rob Bilott, which was, of course, the subject of the film Dark Waters. Is it time to get really hard on industry? And do you, as a scientist and the scientific community, come under pressure from industry to go soft on them so they don't get taken to court or forced to make change?
I've been very careful to maintain impartiality as a scientist. But I think there is a potential conflict of interest with industry funding of academia. And then in terms of, you know, being harder on industry, the place I think industry is really useful is for being transparent about the magnitudes of chemicals that they're releasing to the environment. And they have actually been very helpful in developing these release inventories. And I think the trust element, as you point out, isn't there. And there's a lot of reasons to be skeptical. So I think that's where you need government panels and independent panels to verify data coming from industry. But I don't think that just, you know, saying we should have no conversation or attachment to industry, because industry is also serving us, right? And we as the public are consuming those products.
Yes, you talked about official oversight being needed, and that's something we heard about from Desmond Desar, because even though South Africa has a law that polluters must pay, that's actually meant that the only data that there's been on the disaster and its aftermath is from the company. The company have paid for that cleanup, but they've also been in control of any data coming from there. So there's no oversight or independent data. Is that a global problem?
I think the issue of empowering the affected individuals and the affected communities by chemical pollutants or industry pollution is a globally pervasive problem. And what we need are better mechanisms to quickly support those people. Again, I would point that back to the burden of proof problem. If we go back to the source and we look at what we're releasing, for example, in the 300,000 synthetic organic pollutants, a lot of the parent materials are coming from the fossil fuel industry as well. So as we look to achieve climate goals and look to renewable energy sources, the worry is that that product will switch to manufacturing plastics and synthetic organic chemicals. And I think before that happens, we have to say, and I think we're starting to say that now, and that's what the Back to Blue initiative is trying to put forward. You say, well, that's not the future we want. Do we need these chemicals in our products? And if not, what are some suitable replacements? And in 80 to 90% of the cases, I think, you know, we don't need to be using the chemistries we're using for the functionality we want. And that's a relatively easier solution. But we have to keep our eye on the ball and make sure that this transitioning industry doesn't turn to massive increases in production of different chemicals that we don't necessarily want or huge quantities of plastic. And I think if the public talks about that and you guys keep talking about it and the world says, you know, no, that's not the future we want, it won't happen. And that in turn will protect our marine ecosystems.
Thank you so much, Professor Elsie Sunderland, for joining us on the Watershed Investigations.